So this morning, I want to talk about two metaphors for Zen practice, Zen transformation. And the first one is peeling away layers of the onion. And the second is the alchemical process of turning base metal into gold. So, how about the layers of the onion first? So, when we meditate, we have different experiences. And at the outer layer of the onion is our chattering, is our complaining, is our regretting, is our rehearsing, is our pissing and moaning. Know about this yet? You tried meditation yet? How long you tried it for? How long did that calmness last before the complaining kicked in, before the pissing and moaning kicked in? The outer layer of the onion, right? Then, next layer of the onion, called the afflictive emotions in some traditional Buddhist thought. The afflictive emotions, they afflict us. We're afflicted by our anger, by our sadness, by our jealousy. We're afflicted. So in our sitting, the outer layer is pretty much covering up the second layer. All of that stuff that we're gossiping about, that we're churning about, is, what do you say? It gets its power from the afflictive emotions. So as we begin to peel away the onion, we begin to experience directly the afflictive emotions. And of course, that's a little bit startling, confusing. So then we've got a new afflictive emotion, which is our confusion about what this meditation process is all about. Is it about cultivating afflictive emotions? Hardly. All of that stuff, all of that monkey mind stuff comes out of emotion. When the mind is completely tranquil, the monkey mind stuff doesn't happen. Monkey goes from maybe one couple trees and then relaxes and eats bananas all day. Just doesn't happen. So, as we peel away these different layers of this raw onion, this onions are raw, these emotions are raw, especially when we just are with them, and we're not gossiping about them and saying they shouldn't be so, and, you know, da-da-da, we should make more progress, we should quit this, we should do something else, etc., etc. When we're just raw, when we start to cry a little bit as we're peeling the onion, right? A little bit or a lot? I don't know. We don't know. It just happens. As we keep peeling, underneath the secondary kleshas, the secondary afflictive emotions, they're the three primary afflictions, which some of you know very well. Actually, you all know them well, but some of them, you have studied them in your Buddhist study, and others of you have not studied them, but it's kind of irrelevant because you know them. Greed, hatred, and delusion. Underneath that anger, there's some fundamental sense of not having enough, needing more, needing to push away that which is helping me, which is preventing me from getting enough to feel whole. So Oh, I'm angry at you, Kate, because you're blocking me. You're blocking me from getting it. So if I peel away, I feel those primary holes in my psyche, holes in Tim that I want to try to stuff up with having you like me, having you be there for me. And then pushing you away who diss me. I don't even want you to come to Zen Center. I'm glad you dropped out. Never come again. But that's true. That's raw. Everybody experiences it. We like to fake it, but it's here. If you peel away these layers, you experience this stuff. And then you probably don't ever want to meditate again. But this is good. This is good. This is what it's all about. What? Good. Let's explore that together. In stillness. In stillness. And then continuing the peeling, we peel to the next layer, below the greed, hatred, and delusion, but below the fundamental pull push. And what do we have? We've got avidya in Sanskrit, blindness, cut offness. I can't see anything. I don't have vision. Lack of vision, lack of vid, lack of vision. No wonder I'm pushing and pulling, because I can't see. I feel completely cut off. I'm born alone. I get sick alone. I die alone. I can't see. I'm in avidya, lack of seeing, lack of seeing. I'm lonely. Lonely. So I peel that. That's, we're getting down close to pay dirt now when we do this. Pay dirt. And the payoff is nothing in particular. But if you look for something in particular, you're back up to the outermost layer of the onion. You got to go in. And actually, you can get more concentrated as you go in. The outer layers, you're not very concentrated. The inner layers can help you get concentrated. You may feel a little wigged out, but you get concentrated. Two. And then, from there, all of a sudden, there are no layers left. And there's just openness. There's just openness. There's just availability of everything. Supposedly, Buddha is the archetypal hero, right? The archetypal hero who went through all this and then went through it again the last 24 hours before he had his great awakening. And then, in his awakening, he passed through his loneliness to the great aloneness that includes everything that's joyful. It's joyful because everything's included in it. Everything. Everything. And you don't even know about things, and you don't know about every, and you know about included. You get it? You don't get it. There's nothing to get. Right? Only I, alone and sacred. But that's big I. That's the eye of your nose, the eye of your mouth, the eye of the floor. The eye of I, the eye of the lake, the eye of frozen, the eye of winter, the eye of summer. Only I, alone and sacred. You're sacred, just as you are. Everything's sacred. That's Zen transformation you've got, more or less. 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 So that's one analogy. And while we're doing this process, attention swings wildly. especially at the outer layers. It swings wildly, carried here and there by our thoughts, by our emotions, by our desires, and when it's not, by our boredom, by our fantasies. And that's okay. That's part of the whole deal. Part of the deal. So I have a friend that I don't see very often because he lives in my hometown, and I have not lived in my hometown for, 40 years or something. Okay. Sorry I ever left. Too late now. Too late now. You know, here I am. So, my friend has been a Zen practitioner. Well, he's about 15 or 20 years younger than I am, but for a long time in California. So, I'm gonna use him as an example of layers. Now, he probably will not agree to this, but he doesn't know I'm giving this talk, and I'm not telling him his real name. So. You know, meaning I just watched him. I was with him. I communicated with him over the years. And so I'm extrapolating that to explain these layers, okay? So let's see, what should we call him? Let's call him Fred. Okay, so Fred. So Fred, about 20 years ago, Fred's son got arrested for dealing. And back then in California, they were tough. You know, they were putting everybody in jail. And he had been caught using grass, I think, once before, maybe twice before. So when he was caught for selling just a little bit of marijuana, not very much, they put him away. They put him away. I mean, long time, long time. You guys, if you've been following this, you know about this. Long time. So my friend. My friend has one son, no daughters, single parent, and he was very close to his son. So, and my friend's a meditator, been a meditator for a while, good at meditation, a Zen priest. I better not say much more because I'll start giving him away. Or maybe I can make stuff up as I go along. We'll see. So, you know, he's a Zen priest. This is happening to him. This is happening to him. He's been sitting in meditation for a long time. So what does he experience? He experiences he's back at the outer layer of the onion again. He's a Zen teacher. And there he is back at the outer. Because he's worried about his son. He's thinking about his son. He's regretting all the times he wasn't there for his son. He's feeling guilty. He's feeling pissed at the authorities and their lack of compassion. So when he sits down to Zazen, he's just at the outer layer of it. And he's a Zen teacher. He's a Zen teacher. But he knows that he knows what he's committed to. So he does. He stays with it. He stays with it. And he stops being a teacher for a while and just practices. He doesn't tell people why. He just does it. He's not let's see. Well, you know, he's not an abbot like me. okay. So he practices, and he experiences exactly what I was talking about. He experiences that after a while, if he stays with it, all the blaming focuses in on his anger, and his sadness. And all the chattering about what should have been, and what might have been, and what could have been, and what should have been, it becomes more one-pointed with the afflictive emotions themselves, with the anger and the sadness. Just to be with them, not to do anything about them. This isn't therapy. This sounds like therapy. This isn't therapy. It's not therapy. Being with it. Being kind to it. Being open to it. Allowing it to be because it's what is. And if some tears come up as the onion peels, fine. Let the tears come up. Keep some Kleenex. Pretty simple. And then underneath his anger, his sadness, feeling not whole anymore. He only has one son. He's a single father, alienated from his wife years ago. So he's not whole. He's missing something. He wants to fill it up by pulling people in who will like him and pushing away people who are going to diss him. The primary afflictions which cause all this secondary emotional turmoil. He experiences that. And when he experiences that, he can become actually calm or more settled and not taken away by his emotional stuff. And he's doing practice periods, which we do here in Minnesota, and they do a lot in California. Well, I'm not saying they do them more in California, just that the Zen Center that I was at had two practice places you could go to do practice periods. One in Mill Valley called Green Gulch, and one in Carmel Valley called Tassajara. So we have practice periods here, and they're wonderful, and we're having one coming up soon, and I want to advertise it and have you all come. In which we do our best to try to do practice periods like they did in ancient China and Japan. But the advantage that California has is they have these places you can go for the 7 weeks, you can go for the 8 weeks. So we have a little bit more. It's a little more difficult for us, I think. A little more difficult, but that's good. That's good. Remember? That's good. So then my friend in his practice periods, he went between Green Gulch and Tassajara. He went through all this stuff. He went through all this stuff. And he experienced a deep sense of being cut off. And sitting facing a wall doesn't help the feeling of being cut off. On the contrary, it exacerbates it. Well, this is what we do. This is our practice. This is our practice. And through that, he had a real experience of dropping everything dropping away, and just feeling joined to all life. But he had to go through all those layers of the onion to do it. Everybody does. Everybody does. And there's no guarantee once you get to the center that you won't bounce back out to the outermost layer like he did. There are no guarantees in life. You need some other religion if you want guarantees. But they won't work anyway, so. So that's the onion metaphor. Now how about the alchemical metaphor? So medieval alchemists were trying to, they thought they could convert base metals into gold. And now whether they could or couldn't is not an issue I'm going to get into. But spiritually, we can do it. We do it. That's what Zen practice is all about. That's what it's about. Exactly. Exactly. Jnanaponika Tera, the Buddhist monk, says, in almost every bad situation, there is the possibility of a transformation by which the undesirable may be changed into the desirable. Base metal into gold. It's a kind of a judo. We embrace an experience, whatever experience, as part of our path by making it the focus of our bare awareness, of our meditation. We embrace it. Instead of seeing disturbance and turmoil as a distraction, Anaponika tells us we turn enemies into our friends because all of these disturbances and antagonistic forces have become our teachers. So, basic Buddhist teaching is that these disturbing emotions are covering our essential goodness, like clouds are covering the sun. Often I say to my students, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And that's maybe after they've just told me some awful story.
But that's true. It's true. This is what you discover at base level if you do this.
It's not the good that contrasts with good and bad.
It's not bad.
Because this is. This is. Good in the middle. Good in the beginning and good in the end. We don't even know what the middle and the beginning and the end are. It's just because it is. Just because we are. It's because we are. So we want to remove our psychological pain, and that's the base metal that we want to remove. And we can learn to attend to it. We can learn to be there with it, with kindness, with an open heart. We can feel it, and we can watch it transform into something very, very precious. Very precious. We can all do this. Don't have to have some rigorous daily sitting practice where you do 16 minutes for da 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 da. This is more existential. Do you understand? Sitting is important, but it's more existential than sitting. And of course, I can't leave out the fact that sometimes we may have, any of us may have a diagnosed mental illness. And then we need to medicate our biochemistry so we can do this. We need to medicate our biochemistry so that we can actually do this practice. This practice is works just as well. Or someone, anyone. But if we're really caught with a mental illness, we need to balance our biochemistry so that we can do this, so that we can turn the base metal into gold. So my old friend Rumi. I've probably read this 20 times, this poem. Even if there are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house, empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. Disturbance as evidence that something possibly is waking up in your life. Possibly something is waking up in your life because you're allowing yourself to be there with the disturbance without indulging it, without impressing it, repressing it, without drugging and alcoholing it. No ego state is taboo in our practice. We say, oh, go beyond ego. Okay, go beyond ego if you want. But the way to go beyond ego is to realize that no ego state is taboo. Whatever painful experience we have, if we're just with it, it can soften our hearts. It can soften our hearts, and we can develop some real compassion for ourselves and for others. My friend, I think, I don't know, but I think he's probably a much better Zen teacher now because of doing this with his son. I mean, I'm sorry. I feel sad about it still. But people who've written me from California about the depth of his talks and his teaching say that he's changed completely. Changed completely. Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting. I think the rest, this is Rumi too, but I'm not sure. I can't remember, and I can't remember. The inner being of a human being is a jungle. Sometimes wolves dominate, sometimes wild hogs. Be aware when you breathe. At one moment, gentle, generous qualities like Joseph's or Mary's pass from one nature to another. The next moment, vicious qualities move in hidden ways. At every moment, a new species arises in the chest.
Have you ever noticed this in your zatha?
At every moment, a new species arises in the chest. Now a demon, now an angel, now a wild animal. Just when you're sitting facing the wall, looking so proper, looking so still, looking so composed. There are also those in this amazing jungle who can absorb you into their own surrender. If you have to stalk and steal something, steal from them. Steal from them. So, the inner being of a human being is a jungle. Sometimes wolves dominate, sometimes wild hogs. Be aware when you breathe. So this is about breathing. Our Zen meditation is all about breathing. Breathing catalyzes this whole process, this whole transformative process. And you may think like the transformative process is going awry. It doesn't go awry. That's just your judgment. If you do it, it can't go awry. There's no awry. That's just another wild animal coming in. Another wild animal passing through. So the breath catalyzes this process, allows us to open to our afflictive emotions, to the underlying push-pull, our sense of cut-offness, and the great I-ness, the great joinedness of all life, in which we're totally at peace, totally at peace. Because we let all this stuff pass through. We just let it pass through. We even enjoy it when it passes through. We cry some. We laugh some. We learn to disidentify. We identify with something much, much bigger. It's not a thing at all. Not a thing at all. At every moment, a new species arises in the chest. Now a demon, now an angel, now a wild animal. There are also those in this amazing jungle who can absorb you into their own surrender. If you have to stalk and steal something, steal from them. So we can be absorbed into the wild beings within us. We can stalk them. We can steal their power. This is the alchemical process of transforming the basis emotion, the basis metal, the basis feeling into gold. Into gold. If I can do it, you can do it. No doubt about it. No doubt about it. So in a And we have all of these base emotions, all these afflictive emotions. We don't have to wait till we get to some deep level to make use of them. We can make use of them at any time. Anger can evoke the fierceness of the warrior. Anger can evoke the fierceness of the warrior. So we can use it. We can use it as part of our Buddhist practice, part of our Zen practice. Well, you have to pay attention to it. You have to pay attention to it. You have to come close to it and become in a way intimate with it and see what's going on. See what's going on with that anger. See what evokes it, what it's about. See how you can channel its power. It's got a lot of raw power into helping yourself or others. And it doesn't always work, but sometimes it does. Sometimes it does. And if you bring yourself back, you can learn how to feel that its force, its power, without spilling it out over everyone else. Without spilling it, without generalizing it to everyone else. In my own case, I've been lucky with anger. Just as an example, because Let's see. So I've talked about this a lot, but I haven't talked about this specifically about anger. I'll talk about it in here. My brother committed suicide. I was the older brother who was supposed to take care of him in my mind, and I didn't take care of him. I felt really angry. I felt angry at him for doing it. I felt angry at me for letting him down. I felt angry at my parents. You know how anger starts small and shh. And here I was. I talk about this all the time. These guys have heard me talk about this lots of times. But you ask the question, so I guess I'm talking about it again. Here I was sitting in meditation with that anger. So how can I develop clarity of intention to make use of that anger? And over the years, I did. I worked with it. The anger was partly about shame and blame. I felt ashamed. I blamed myself. I blamed others. So clarity of intention. How can I take that clarity of intention that I see that and to help others who feel ashamed or blamed about some type of emotional breakdown? So that's what I worked on for years. How can I? I felt angry that my brother was locked up. That he killed himself when he was locked up. When he shouldn't have been locked up. So my clarity of intention is how can I kind of try to change things so that people won't be locked up so much. And my intention got unclear a lot of times. It still gets unclear a lot of times. And I'd start spilling my anger onto other people and blaming other people. Then I come back to my practice. Transmuting the base metal into gold. What's my intention here? Not to piss him off. Not to blame someone. My intention is to say less blaming. So now I'm blaming people for stigmatizing? Well, what am I doing? What am I doing when I'm blaming people for stigmatizing? Right? So I come back to my clarity of intention. My clarity of intention. Time and time again, moment after moment. And that's how we actually convert this, whatever this emotion is, into something helpful to all beings. But we fall down on the job, but still we do it. We try and try, and finally we do it. And my third clarity, my third intention, since you mentioned it, with my brother, was this whole thing about kicking people out of treatment programs when they use.
If you get caught, you're out, right?
Yeah. Because that ultimately was the last straw, was what did my brother in, because he had great depression underneath. And they kept kicking him out and kicking him out and kicking him out. So my intention is, I want to blame everybody. But that's not my intention. Is to deal with the anger in a way that's helpful to everybody, helpful to people. So how can we do it differently? So I have to discipline myself, but not discipline myself as bad, as a disciple of Buddha, as a disciple of truth. Even though we don't know what truth is, as a disciple of interdependence, I'm a disciple of interdependence. I screw up and then I come back, and then I come back, and I come back. And I use my strong emotion to help me instead of spill it all over everything. And when I notice it's spilling over everyone and everything, or I'm magnifying it, then I compassionately come back to my breath. Come back to my breath. What do you think?
Well, articulated.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well articulated. Well articulation is cool, but not the most important thing. Not the most important thing. The most important thing is how we can help each other. How we can help each other struggle with all these strong urges and desires that we have, and just come back to the awareness of our breath so that we can really be here for each other. So I've talked a few months ago here about Ram Dass, and I'll talk again about him just briefly. Now, Ram Dass. So I saw Ram Dass. I'm old, right? I saw Ram Dass in the 60s. Well, if I tell you I seen Ram Dass in the 60s, then I've got to be old, right? I saw Ram Dass in the 60s, because some of you weren't alive then when I saw him. I saw Ram Dass in the 80s, and I saw Ram Dass on a video here in Minneapolis in 2001 in a big screen. Okay, so in the 60s, Ram Dass and Timothy Leary, they're the LSD guru guys, right? And Ram Dass comes to Stanford when I'm a student. And he's touting LSD as the panacea to big mind, to opening up. And he's kind of interesting, and I'm interested in him. I'm enough to go to the talk, and he's an entertainer, and LSD is the way. And I think at the time, well, I've already gotten into Zen practice, so I think, well, I don't know. He's kind of simplifying this, LSD is the way thing. But he's got a grandiosity to him that is a little suspicious, but also kind of appealing. I mean, grandiosity is appealing. And then, of course, I'm giving him as an example of an example of alchemical process or peeling the onion, but I don't really know the guy, so okay. So then, he puts aside LSD. He starts doing a serious meditation practice. He goes to India. He has a guru. He writes "Be Here Now." Then I see him, and then he comes to the Twin Cities in the mid-80s. I see him, and of course, he's no longer Timothy Leary. He's now Ram Dass. He's no longer dressed like a college teacher. He's dressed however Ram Dass dressed. I don't remember. But, probably in white or something with beads. I don't know. You guys may remember. So now he's doing kind of much closer to what I'm doing. Now he's doing meditation. There's a huge group that comes sees him. I don't know where it is. Not too far from here. Talk. And he's very serious about his meditation, very serious about his practice, and very encouraging to people. And people I think we're all taken. But there's still a lot of him in this. A lot of him. A lot of his. My teacher. My meditation. And you can even see his dress. I mean, he's sort of attracting attention by his dress. He may not even... But he's cool, And many people are doing meditation as a result. Be Here Now is becoming a big book, right? All over the place. And then, in 1997, he has a stroke. He has a really bad stroke, right? And... So when I see him on video, and I'm sure this is on YouTube, or whatever that is, I'm sure you can watch it on YouTube. There he is in the video, and he's had his stroke, and the video is titled, has anybody seen the video? Oh, okay. I haven't seen it since 2001, so maybe that's all wrong. The video is titled "Fierce Grace," and in "Fierce Grace," he's completely recognizing and accepting his limitations. He just is. He's working with them, and we see him patiently lifting his leg with his hands to get in and out of the car. Because he has to use both hands to get his leg in and out of the car. We see the slowness of each movement, its precision, how cautious he is.
with no hint of frustration, no hint of crankiness toward his attendants. And his attendants are like, they seem to be his peers. It's not like he's higher up. Like, you know, they're his friends. They really feel like that. He's their friends and they're his friends. So, alchemical process, right? Alchemical process. No trace of glibness in Fierce Grace. The guy is glib in 1965. He is an entertainer. He comes from a long tradition of Yiddish entertainers. I mean, he is very entertaining. Still in 1985, he is very entertaining. In 2001, he is not entertaining. He is alive to what is. He's not trying to entertain. And his language, you said I was very articulate. He was very articulate in 1965 and 1985. 2001, he's not that articulate. Well, he's had a stroke. He's had a stroke. He can't be that articulate. His words are few and far between. But he's got such humility and such sincerity that we didn't see during those early years. We didn't see. But he's kept the practice going all this time. And he says, I am more at peace now than ever. And that comes from settling into the moment. Settling into the moment. So he's using his physical limitations to return to what's real. We use whatever base metal comes along our way. Whatever base metal comes along our way. He says, over all these years, I've worked in India, helping the poor, played the cello, golf, drove my MG. Since the stroke, the cars in the driveway, the cello and golf clubs in the closet. If I think I'm the guy who can't play cello or drive or work in India, I would feel terribly sorry for myself. But I'm not him. During the stroke, I died again, and now I have a new life in a disabled body. This is where I am. You got to be here now. So, the Zen practice is about ego disidentification. But the way we disidentify with ego is not by trying to disidentify with ego. It's the opposite. It's judo. It's by getting close, seeing what is with your kind awareness. And then there's a possibility from that for real transformation. Real transformation. And ultimately there's disidentification with a practitioner. With the Tim, with the Ben. Just disidentification with the practitioner who was trying to get somewhere. And that's considered in Buddhist practice as the conversion of the three basic kleshas, greed, hatred, and delusion, into generosity, love, and wisdom. And it happens. It happens. So I had there was a guy here named Peter. There was a guy named Peter who was a Koga student on the Shakuhachi, and Leo remembers Koga when Koga was here.
I don't remember when he was here.
Oh. I lived in California. But Koga was a master. It still is a master Shakuhachi player. A master Shakuhachi player. And Koga lived here and taught the Shakuhachi. And if you listen to Leo, you'll learn something. Just as we listened to Koga, we learned something. Not something to talk about, not something to be articulate about, but something deep and wonderful. So Peter became Koga's student. And Koga wanted Peter to practice 2 hours a day on the Shakuhachi when Koga was here and Peter was here. And Peter couldn't make a sound out of that bamboo flute. But Leo plays so adroitly.
so naturally.
It took me a couple weeks to get a sound.
And Kogre said, that's okay. Just continue. And Peter said, well, all this stuff is coming up all the time. He said, that's part of it. That's part of it. Just let it come up. Come back to the shakuhachi. So Peter finally made a sound. I think he said it. He told me it took him almost 2 months to make a sound. Well, maybe, I don't know why it took him that long, but that's what he said. And he stayed with it. He stayed with it. That became his practice. And I ran into this woman, Jane, who came here a while ago, and she said that she had seen Peter on the East Coast, and Peter now is a shakuhachi teacher, and that he has a real stillness about him. So this is 20 years. 20 years of dealing with the base metal of the frustration of not being able to make a sound of a shakuhachi, and then all kinds of weird sounds coming out, until finally, he has many people wanting to come to be students, according to Jane. I don't know what that she said. So this takes time, this practice. Don't get discouraged. It takes time. It takes time. Anything, doesn't matter what you do. Anything you do, any artistic or musical or even, it will take time. It will take time. So I'll close by the story that I've told before about Otohiro. So Otohiro was the son of my teacher, Shinryu Suzuki. And I said to Otohiro was studying to be a barber in San Francisco. You know, a Zen master with a son who was a barber. It was cool. We liked it. And I said to Otohiro once, I said, Otohiro, what did I say? Oh, your father is wonderful. He's so gentle and patient. And he said, not father I grew up with. I said, oh, no, not same man. That man mean. That man angry. Not same man. That's all he said. So I think I should stop now and see if there are questions or comments. Yeah,
Tim, I have a question. Since you're a psychologist by background and Zen teacher, like the psychological disorder of depersonalization,
mm-hmm.
and how that would be different from successful mindfulness, essentially.
The psychological order of depersonalization and how that would be different from mindfulness. Well, in depersonalization, instead of getting closer, we move away. We actually consciously disidentify to avoid being there with the pain. So the disidentification that takes place naturally is replaced by an artificial disidentification, which we just can't tolerate the pain. So we move into a numbing, disidentifying state, which is totally the opposite of disidentification in this process. So I don't even, that makes me not want to use the word disidentification in this process. I'm always changing words. But that's a very good question. Very good question, but they're 180 degrees from each other. In one, you're consciously divorcing yourself from stuff. You're consciously retreating into an affectless world to protect yourself. To protect ego. In the other, you are actually going into the lion's cave. You are actually going in to it with your breathing to be there with it. So there, that's my answer. Do you have a response? Or?
Yeah, I mean, they seem the same to me, other than one's going to swim and the other's going to sink, so to speak.
Well, no, they're not the same. When you're depersonalizing, you're not opening your heart. You're closing your heart. You're detaching yourself. You're running away. You're fleeing. When you're doing this practice, you're kindly and openly embracing what comes. You're accepting rather than rejecting. In depersonalization, there's an ultimate rejection of everything. In this, there's a gradual openness and acceptance of it. Yeah.
You have a phrase that you mentioned to me, protecting the ego. In one case, you're associated to protect ego. In the other case, you're letting go of ego.
That's pretty good. Yeah. That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Sure. Thank you.
Maybe one more question.
Okay. Stacy, did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm interested in Ram Dass, and I saw Fierce Grace, it was a long time ago that I saw it, and I remember that there was a young activist, and she was telling the story of a friend of hers who'd been killed just outside. And he kept saying, "That's your story, you're making up this story," and I just thought it was so mean at the time.
Oh.
And I guess I understand better now the value of that wisdom. And And I also went, so my question really, that's the comment, but my question really is that, so be here now is the phrase, be here now, remember. And I wonder, what do you think that means?
I don't remember what he said. He said, "Be here now, remember."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Be here now, remember." I don't know. I don't know what he meant by that. Do you? Huh? What'd you say?
Be here now, right? I mean,
but she's saying that there's a word "remember" afterward.
Be here now, and then maybe a paramedic.
Well, in a way, this process we say that we're turning base metal into gold, but actually we're remembering that it's all gold. That memory is covered up by all these layers. But the center of the onion, it's always still. So we're not really converting base metal into gold. It's all gold already. We need to remember that. I mean, that's a way that I could talk about it always. Because that is hidden in our psyche. It's there, that we're it already. Beginner's mind, we're it.
Thank you.
Sure.
February 22nd. Spring practice period begins next month. Tim, do you want to say anything about practice period?
Oh, I've just been talking about it.
Yeah.
I've been talking about it for 47 minutes. So join us. It'll be fun. And not fun in a superficial sense, but actually we have more fun when we embrace this stuff, you guys. It's not scary anymore. We don't need to disidentify anymore. We just have more fun because we take it in. We see that it's what we are already, what everything is already. So join us and we'll have fun.
One of MZMC's founders, Eric Sterling, has written a new memoir called Go Deep and Take Plenty of Root. Join us on Friday, March 14th at 7:30 p.m. to hear Eric read selections from his book and reflect on the development of Zen in the Midwest. Is Mark Trevac here? The Twin Cities community is partnering to help build two homes with Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity this March. Over 50 community members from Clouds and Water Zen Center, Dharma Field, and Minnesota Zen Meditation Center will help build community and transform the lives of well-deserving families by helping them realize the dream of home ownership. For complete details, see the Bodhisattva Build flyer posted on the front bulletin board. Also, MZMC has launched a weekly work practice volunteer program. We are seeking volunteers to come in each week to perform tasks around the building while exploring mindfulness at work. For complete details, see the work practice volunteer program bulletin board down the hall to the left. Thank you. Details about retreats, classes, and events are on the website. You can register for them on the front bulletin board, online, or by contacting the office. If you're new to the Zen Center, we welcome you and thank you for coming. Please join us for tea and introduce yourself so we can get to know you better. And if you come regularly, you can consider becoming a member. It's a great way to support the center and receive reductions on classes and other activities. And there's yellow membership brochures on the front porch.